and welcome to Upzoned, where each week we take just one story that's been buzzing around the Strongtowns conversation and we upzone it. I'm Kia, and I'm here with our president and founder, Chuck Marone. How are you doing, Chuck?
Hey, doing fantastic. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. As you know, we got a puppy this week, so I am in deep dog mode. I have my partner downstairs sort of wrangling the little rugrat, and you know, I'm constantly on the alert for potty training accidents, and we are kind of full steam ahead over at the Wilson Bowman household. What's new in Minnesota?
It's so funny because we got married, my wife and I, and got a dog 11 months later. A little puppy. You know, we were like, we're going to get married and we're going to have kids, because we had dated for 8 years, you know, all through junior high and high school and college. And so we got done with college and we're like,
yep, us too.
And we had this puppy and it's like, yeah, maybe we should wait on kids. I think we were married 8 or 9 years until we had finally had kids. And it was like, oh my gosh. I just recognized like dogs are a lot of love. But also a lot of work. And it's like, I think kids are a little bit more than
probably. Yeah. Because they can do more than just pee in your house, which is my
exactly.
number one concern at the moment. So, well, I'm excited to have a little bit of time away from new motherhood to talk about other things I'm passionate about, namely this really interesting article that I ran across on Planetizen. It's actually picking up on an article that came out a little bit before the holidays on CityLab, and it's about the idea of applying the cap and trade model to the affordable housing problem. So if you're not familiar with cap and trade, it was probably most well known in the like eco space. So if you're a high polluting industry and you have a federal regulation on how many emissions, say, you can put out into the environment, it's capped, you can trade your ability to emit a little bit more with an industry that emits less, and you pay them money basically for the privilege of polluting more. In the affordable housing model, New Jersey has actually been doing this for 2 decades, apparently. I had no idea. A neighborhood that has recently upzoned, for instance, has allowed the next level of intensity. Say they're a single family neighborhood and all of a sudden they're allowing, you know, 2, 3, 4 multifamily apartment buildings, can go to a neighborhood next door, sitting next door, and say, I'd like to pay you to basically take our overflow to like downzone and keep our neighborhood under glass a little bit. It's an interesting idea. And I would like to talk about it with you, Chuck, through the lens of the Strongtowns conversation. What do you think about cap and trade as a solution? Is it market-based wisdom? Is it a artificial way to stifle growth that we should be allowing? What's your gut reaction when you hear about this?
I was kind of fascinated by it. And my gut reaction was, this is really odd. And so I spent some time like digging into it to try to understand it a little bit better. I've got 2 non-New Jersey models for you. I want to give you one and I want to have you kind of react to it. Before we talk about New Jersey, it's kind of an interesting application of this. So when I was in graduate school, I was doing a lot of zoning work for lake cities with a lot of lakes. In fact, the city I used to live in was called East Gull Lake, and it was literally the east side of Gull Lake, one of the richest, most expensive, most exclusive lakes in central Minnesota. And part of this was we would have these small little cabins that had been built sometimes in the Depression era, but I mean, they were old and small. And these properties were worth millions of dollars. People would come in, scrape off the small little cabin and build their mega mansion on the lake. One of the impacts of this was increased water runoff into the lake, which decreased the water quality, damaged the lake, had all kinds of negative impacts. And the thing is, it was never like a point impact, right? Like a sewer pipe into the lake that you could deal with. It was always this like cumulative impact, a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there. It all adds up and it has this negative effect. There were these great studies that showed when you reach a certain level of intensity of development, and the way we measured it was impervious coverage. When you reach a certain level of impervious coverage within the watershed, you start to have these negative impacts on the lake. This was pretty good science. And so if you could keep more of it green, if you could absorb that water, you were going to improve the overall lake quality. We allowed up to 25% of the property to be covered. And that was the state standard. Like the state of Minnesota said, all lakes everywhere in the first tier, so the right along the shoreline, you can cover up to 25%. And what we recognized was that the science was suggesting that like 12 or 14%, somewhere in that range, was actually the threshold where you should be at. And above that, things started to go bad. So in these highly intensely developed lakes, or these lakes that were developing very intensely, I came up with, as part of my grad school studies, a cap and trade system. We set an overall goal of like 15% for the shoreline. You were allowed up to 20. So we lowered it from 25 to 20 from what the state said. But you could go back up to the state's limit, 25, if you bought out and essentially traded 5% with your neighbors. And the idea, like the goal here, was like to have an overall rate that was closer to what was kind of viable in the ecosystem. How do you think this was received?
I wonder. Tell me.
Well, understand that when I proposed this, everyone could go up to 25%. So what I was talking about was basically to allow people to go back up to 25%, but to spend money mitigating that on other parcels. So I was not like proposing to give them 30% or 40% or something they couldn't already get. I was just saying, here's a mechanism whereby we can actually, from a market standpoint, improve the ecosystem. I got the, you're doing this for rich people. Rich people are going to benefit. Rich people are going to pay their way. It basically got down to a fairness argument. If I'm poor and I own a lake lot, I should be treated the same as a rich person who owns a lake lot. Now, that was ludicrous because no poor people owned lake lots. There were people who thought of themselves as poor because it was like a, you know, a relative comparison. I'm poor because I inherited this $2 million lake property from my family and I own it in joint with like three of my siblings. And so I'm poor compared to the guy next door who, like, this is his third home and just scraped it off and built a $12 million mansion. Okay. Poor, like relatively speaking, but not poor. But it all came down to this discussion of fairness. Someone could buy their way to something that I could not get myself under the law without paying for it. And it basically became like this huge nightmare that just went away, basically. Like nobody wanted this. Nobody thought this was good. Even the state regulatory agencies who were searching for ways to improve the ecosystem and lower the impact of impervious surfaces, that they rejected it too. They're like, we can't do this. Like this is, you know, it came down to a class thing. Does that surprise you? Because I, in retrospect, it like doesn't surprise me, but I think I was naive and kind of.
I mean, it surprises me that Minnesotans were that forward in their criticism. That's why I was like, well, maybe tell me what they said. I had the same gut reaction to this article about New Jersey when I first read it. But as the piece goes on, it makes some interesting conclusions. It talks about a paper that was published by someone named Robert Wassmer, whose name I'm probably mispronouncing, and his research partner, whose name I'm going to pronounce even more poorly, Imayaz Wahid. They published a paper basically that said that functionally, what would this look like and what would happen? And I actually just want to read a quote from it because I thought it was really interesting. Cap and trade between communities with similar outlooks and incomes would look different. Affluent NIMBYs, not in my backyard people, if you're new to this, would have to find other affluent NIMBYs and reach a deal, Wassmer says. This might shed light on the irrational beliefs, racism and classism behind the rational motivations, perceived home value underlying NIMBYism. Wassmer says that he predicts that in a true neighborhood cap and trade, no trading would happen at all. So basically, he was like, people would be too embarrassed to take advantage of these systems because it would make them look like racist, classist jerks, which I found kind of a fascinating theory. What are your reactions to that?
Yeah, or I think that's tell nuts. Me,
yeah.
I think that, okay, go for I don't it. Think that that's like how humans work at all. And this gets me kind of a little bit to my second example. We have here in Minnesota the Metropolitan Planning Board, it's the Met Council. We plan, and it's kind of like looked at as innovative around the country. I think we could debate that. But we mandate across 7 counties in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Basically, like, we got planning standards for these places. And one of the things that we say, and I'm going to word it in this way kind of intentionally, although they might say it a little differently, every city has to accept their proportion of affordable housing. So if you are Minneapolis and St. Paul, the core cities, you have a certain amount of affordable housing you need to have. If you are Woodbury or Afton or, you know, one of these affluent second, third exurban kind of places, you also have to take your share of affordable housing. And this has been a hugely controversial issue, particularly when you get out into these suburbs where they're like, you know, we're not taking, okay, maybe we'll put an apartment next to the interchange on the frontage road, but we're not integrating affordable housing into our core neighborhoods. It's just not, like, it's not what we do. We want large lots. We want space. And if you can't afford that, sorry, you're not going to live here. I was thinking about what a cap and trade system would look like there. And the funny thing that has always bothered me about this system is it's the idea that we should be seeking to accommodate poor people in exurban areas because it's what? Good for the poor people? Good for exurban areas? Like, why? This is some of the most expensive place to live. It's got horrible transit service. It's like brutally expensive in your time and automobile expenses to live there. Why do we want to force people who have fewer financial resources out into suburban and exurban areas? So what if we went to these places who don't want them for a variety of reasons, and you can look at them as immoral or just like gross, yucky people. I don't care. But what if we went to them and said, okay, you're kind of like thwarting this policy anyway. What if we just charge you to get out of it? Like, what if you just pay and we take that money and we actually use it to help poor people locate in areas that are advantageous for poor people? I don't know. I kind of sense that there's two dimensions. And I kind of think this way about New Jersey too. There's like the practical dimension of, you know, what would actually help someone who financially didn't have a lot of resources. And I actually think that that might be the exact opposite of what would make policymakers and maybe even voters and the well-intentioned feel good about themselves. I think they might be at odds with each other. I don't have necessarily a negative reaction on this New Jersey thing. I don't have a positive one. Like, I'm not suggesting like this is the answer, but I think it's maybe closer to the answer than some of the other crazy things we do, like rent control and inclusionary housing and that kind of thing. I'm all for empowering individuals. And if this is a way we could do that, it's kind of clunky, but it might not be the worst idea.
It's fascinating to me because for people who haven't tuned in before, I come from more of like a traditional, like, liberal, progressive, democratic frame. I live in St. Louis, and the people in my world talk all the time about like how important it is to get low income, underprivileged in other ways, people into communities of more privilege. And there's whole organizations devoted to that in St. Louis. And I vacillate between your reaction of like, Why do we want to do this? We have Ferguson outside of St. Louis already, which started in much the same way. It started with, you know, families of color, low-income families wanting to move into high opportunity areas because they knew, like many people have read, that there's more opportunity for your kids later in life if they grow up around more affluence, if they grow up in a better school district, if they grow up with access to more parks, even if it is more expensive to live in those places. What happened with Ferguson on the long tail of it is that it's one of the most challenging places to live in the St. Louis area now because all of the wealth has left. And what becomes of that? I'm sympathetic to the way that you're talking about it, Chuck, but I guess I'm not super sold that cap and trade is the way to go, because I would love to see, I mean, I guess it comes back to the way that we talk about what it means to build affordable housing in strong towns, that like there is no one form like of a building that is by its nature affordable. A like tiny, tiny unit in New York is not necessarily affordable housing. A giant unit in St. Louis is not necessarily expensive. Sometimes it's quite inexpensive. What matters more is age as buildings filter down to someone who can afford them over time. We own a four family in St. Louis that at one time probably held upper middle class people, and now we're renting to lower income renters because it's 110 years old. How can we approach this holistically? Because the cap and trade thing, the thing that makes me anxious about it is, so what happens, like, does that mean that we're not going to build any accessory dwelling units in the backyards of more expensive neighborhoods? If someone wants to exercise that choice, can they do it, basically? Do you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah, no, totally. I'm going to ask you this because and this is maybe an unfair question, so you can brush it off if you want. I have this sense that there's a certain category of people who, if you had to choose between, you know, like A, housing one person in an affluent neighborhood, or B, taking that same amount of money and instead of having, you know, one poor person rent in an affluent neighborhood, having 10 people of lesser means actually own a home in a poorer neighborhood, there's a certain segment of the population that on principle would pick the first one. And on principle being, you know, yes, there's data that shows that poor kids who grow up in neighborhoods of affluence do better, perform better. You've got better services, you've got better parks, you've got, like, you listed a whole bunch of things. And I think that's very real. Like, I'm not denying that. But to me, there's a certain like short-sightedness about saying those wealthy people should absolutely take their share of this cap and trade as a pollution kind of thing. And so what you're really saying here is that poor people function like pollution. Wealthy neighborhoods should take their portion of pollution, of human pollution. And that's just right. That's the right moral thing to do. It's good for the people that are wealthy. It's good for everybody. Okay, maybe that on principle is what we should do. Maybe that's the Christian thing to do in my lexicon. I don't know. But I feel there's a practical side of me that just says the amount of energy and effort and resources that we would have to expend to get someone a rental marginal place where they're not building their own wealth in a rich neighborhood, it is so bizarrely out of whack. If we could get those resources instead to individuals and allow them a path to buy their own place in a neighborhood they could afford, and then have that neighborhood not be a place that was atrophying, not be a place that is in decline, but a place where we're actually making serious like public capital investments in these places to nudge them along a path of building wealth. Now, all of a sudden, we're doing something that maybe in like the 2-year, 4-year, 5-year timeframe is not as advantageous. But when we're talking lifetimes and generations, now you're talking about changing the wealth equation of people who have less, actually giving them ownership, giving them wealth, allowing them something to pass on. And that's the way historically societies have gotten rich. That's the way you've upended power structures. I think if that's the goal, there's just more pragmatic and practical ways to do it.
I agree. And, you know, to be clear, I run in very progressive circles, but I am that bummer at parties that's like inclusionary zoning isn't doing the thing that you think it's going to do. And your concerns about concentrated poverty are in some ways like a little misguided when you think about the larger issues of a region that's completely wired for decline, even in the richest neighborhoods. You know, like, we have problems everywhere. And how do we address those? It's a really interesting question. I do have friends that would hear that and say, I would rather have like one poor family renting in a rich neighborhood rather than, for instance, like owning homes they can't afford in Detroit that are cheap, but they have a tax bill of $20,000 a year or whatever it is. So it's such a complex thing, but it's also something that I feel like reinforces my desire to see more of our financial systems localized and become more like humble and down to earth about like how do we get people into the houses that they want to live in, you know, and how can we use not just systems and policy, but like actual conversation, person to person, real public engagement where you sit with someone and you talk to them for a long time about their needs to move the ball down the road. So anyway, that's sort of where I'm settling with this cap and trade stuff.
I feel like a big part of what needs to happen in this country in general is that we need to give cities bigger toolboxes. Right now, most of our cities have like three tools they've been given. It's like they've been given a hammer, a Phillips screwdriver, and a little tiny saw. And they're told to do all these like complex things. And the state has basically hoarded all the other tools and not let cities do anything. I think that cities need to be given a big, huge toolbox of things that they can try. I would put some buffers on that. Like, I wouldn't let cities go hugely into debt, you know, trying out their own theories. Like, I would put some limits on what they could do, but they would be kind of like macro limits. And I would let cities experiment. Sometimes when cities experiment, they're going to do things that are really stupid and that don't work. And that's part of the learning process, which we have to go through now to figure out what works at the local level. So when I see this, I know it touches on a bunch, this New Jersey thing, it touches on a bunch of like push button things for people. I would be interested to see a 10-year experiment and what the outcomes were. I know you've got some party dog whistles involved in this, you know, the parties that are proposing it. You're like, well, do they really genuinely care about poor people? I think that if we just assume the best motivations from people and say, okay, if we were going to do this and try to make it work out, and here were our goals, so let's get on the same page with the goals, how does this experiment end up? I think that would be an interesting thing to follow.
Would you want them to do it in Minneapolis, which just adopted the 2040 plan? Like, would you like the neighborhoods who are most afraid of any intensity? Because Minneapolis, for those who aren't familiar with the 2040 plan, is now basically making up to triplexes, I believe, legal citywide. And people who live in single family neighborhoods with giant lawns and setbacks are freaking out over this. Do you want those people with the don't bulldoze our neighborhood signs to be able to cap and trade it away?
Well, no. And I guess here's the way I would frame that. If you said, like, Chuck, what should cities do right now if they want affordable housing? The number one thing, and we've been saying this for years and years and years, and I'm so happy Minneapolis is doing it, you've got to allow the next increment by right. And that's what Minneapolis has done. I wouldn't mess with that. I want that experiment to run for a decade or two. Let's see what happens there when people actually can evolve and change their neighborhoods organically over time. I think it's going to have a dramatic impact that is going to be largely positive. Now, if we went across the river to St. Paul, where they don't have that, and St. Paul said, you know, we've got the same idea, it's the same goals in mind, we want to do the same kind of thing, but we can't do this by right thing, so we're going to try this cap and trade. I would find that to be kind of a loony idea. Like, I'm like, just do what Minneapolis did. I think that makes way more sense. But if they said, we want to do that here, I'm like, okay, if we've got the same goals, like, let's try that out.
Well, I feel like we've gotten pretty deep into the weeds on this one, and I've had a blast. I hope if you've enjoyed listening to this, you let us know. If we're way too wonky for you, also let us know. We're happy to calibrate. But thanks for talking about this with me, Chuck. It's been really interesting. This is a challenging intellectual example. We don't find as many of those as you would think. It's trunk tones. I think a lot of the stuff we're talking about is actually pretty intuitive and instinctual. So that's why I wanted to bring it up. And now I want to talk about the down zone. The down zone is where we talk about the media we've been consuming, kind of anything related or unrelated to Strong Towns that you've been enjoying this week. I would love to hear what you've been up to, Chuck.
Actually, Chloe, my oldest, is doing a lesson at school, and I think it's on World War II, although it might be narrower and focused than that. But they're reading a book called Night by Eli Weisel, and they sent a note home to parents, you know, we're doing this and that there's some sensitivity with it because it deals with the Holocaust. So my wife and I decided to read it along with her. So I just started that. I'm kind of interested. I read something else he wrote. It wasn't that back when I was in eighth grade, which is where Chloe's at right now. I'm interested to read it for myself and also, you know, to have this conversation with a really smart 14-year-old kid.
I love it. Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful memoir. For me, I haven't been getting very deep in the media because I'm in puppy land most of the time right now, but I'm on a bit of a nature documentary kick. I'm having a really good time watching Blue Planet 2 on Netflix, which is like hyper beautiful, high definition, basically videos of fish doing weird stuff. And I love it. It's so good. It's so strange. And I came to the Strongtowns conversation as someone who's interested in just life and the way that creatures make choices and form societies. And, you know, that has spurred a love of economy. But at the core of everything that I'm interested in is just, I like thinking about stuff and about the way that systems work. And the ocean is a really fascinating system. And I learned last night that there are fish who can use tools. And I'm real stressed about that right now. So that's what's been on my mind.
This is why you and I get along so well. We both are interested in systems. Let me tell you one more. So we had our board meeting this last weekend, and part of our board meetings is we generally spend a day at a theme park, which I think we mentioned last week. We were at California Adventure in Anaheim, and it started to rain about 3 o'clock. It started to drizzle a little bit. By the end of the night, which the park closed at 9, it was pouring. And we're headed towards the exit, and it's like 5 to 9. And we were like, we got to do one more thing. And we had put off all day the river ride. I can't even know what it's called. It's like where you get in the raft and you go through the rapids and everything.
Like Cali River Rapids or something like that. Yeah.
Well, that's the one in Animal Kingdom in Florida. This one's something, it's called something different. And I apologize, I don't remember the name of it. But we decided to do this at like 8:58. And the temperatures were like high 40s. It was like 47, 48 degrees. It was cold. When we got done, you could like see your breath a little bit. We had this epic like board ride through the dark, like pitch black, dark, pouring down rain with like ice cold water getting splashed all over. It was so funny to be hanging out with and there were a bunch of other people on the ride too. Like, what are we doing? This is nuts. But it was epic and fun. So one of those memorable moments.
We sound so professional right now. I love it. It's great. No, it actually is. I've been at these meetings and they're shockingly productive. Like way more so.
They are amazingly productive. Yeah.
It's incredible. Actually, it's kind of genius. But all right. Well, thanks so much for listening into Upsound. As always, you can engage with the article we just talked about at length by looking at the article description on Podbean and iTunes. You can always give us 5 stars. And if you are interested in helping us make more of this stuff, go ahead and join the movement. You can do that at strongtowns.org/membership. Every dollar counts. And we really mean that. We are the incremental development folks. So we put every little bit to use. Thank you so much for listening in, and you have a great day. Keep doing what you can to build strong towns.